Let's open our Bibles to Ezekiel chapter number 47. Now, this big section from chapter 40 through 48 is Ezekiel's final vision. And as I've told you pretty much every day that we've studied it, it was intended as the way that the Israelis should act when they came back from Babylonian exile. They were supposed to rebuild this temple described in these passages, rebuild the city of Jerusalem in accordance with these passages. They were supposed to divide the land up, the promised land, according to these passages, to the 12 tribes that were coming back out of exile. And all of this was related to their repentance of past sins and their commitment of faithfulness to their God. And if they had done all of that, according to these prophecies, then God would have sent his visible presence into the temple and would have been in their presence from there on out. And this would have started the river of water of life flowing out of the temple. And it would have brought the Dead Sea to life again. And the tree of life, the forest of life, would have been available for them to eat the 12 crops a year fruit from it. And they would have had the healing properties of the leaves that would have extended life considerably. And this is what would have happened until the Messiah would have come. So the story about Jesus would have been considerably different if they had followed these procedures, but they didn't. We know that there was a lot of feet dragging and a lot of sinful attitudes that came back with them out of Babylonian exile. And because of that, we see nothing about God's Holy Spirit coming and physically, visibly re-inhabiting the budget temple that Zerubbabel built after about a 20-year delay there at Jerusalem. So we ended up only seeing some of these things happen in the millennial period later and in eternity later. I might mention again, I do not believe this is going to be the millennial temple with all the procedures in it, because I don't think there will be any sacrifices or the eating of meat in the millennial period. Other passages indicate otherwise. With Jesus being there as the final, ultimate sacrifice for sin, there's no reason for animal sacrifices. But some of the other things, like the river of water of life, like the forest of the tree of life, those things will come to pass during the millennial period and afterwards, I am convinced. One of the other things that is very likely to happen is that we know that Jesus will set up his kingdom at Jerusalem, and that people will be flowing to worship him out of the upper Middle East, that is up in what we call Iran and Iraq today. They'll be coming down the Highway of Holiness from that direction to come to Jerusalem and worship him. And then they'll also be coming up from the south, out of what today is Egypt and Ethiopia. They'll be coming up along this same Highway of Holiness that's described in other passages to Jerusalem to worship Jesus. And at the center of that will be the Promised Land in the new heaven and new earth that is going to be home to the resurrected and transformed saints, as well as any surviving mortals that came out of Earth's history after the Battle of Armageddon. That is, people who didn't take the mark, but who had not yet embraced Jesus as Savior, so they weren't resurrected or transformed. So this is the millennial period, and I think we'll probably see the dividing up of the inheritance rights for the resurrected Israelis in accordance with these directions here. So this follows hot on the heels of the story about the river of water of life and the tree of life. So the whole land is alive again. Even the valley of the Dead Sea is alive again. And so we start here with the boundaries of this promised land, which they could have occupied after they came back from exile if they had just been faithful. But now it gets postponed to later, I think. So chapter 47 of Ezekiel, verse 17, tells us that the northern boundary is this. It shall run from the sea, that's the Great Sea or the Med, to Hazar Anan, which is on the northern border of Damascus, with the border of Hamat to the north. This shall be the north side. So if you look on a map, then effectively we're talking about from Sidon on the coast out toward Damascus inland. That is the northern border of the promised land in this period. Verse 18, on the east side, the boundary shall run between Hauron and Damascus along the Jordan between Gilead and the land of Israel to the eastern sea and as far as Tamar. This shall be the east side. So basically right down the Jordan Valley, sounds like, ending about halfway between the southern end of the Dead Sea, as it used to be, and the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. That's the approximate area of where Tamar was located. Verse 19, on the south side, it shall run from Tamar as far as the waters of Meribah Kadesh. From there along the brook of Egypt to the Great Sea, this shall be the south side. Now, this is roughly, if you go due west from Petra, that's kind of the level of Tamar and Kadesh Barnea. If you go due west from Petra, you eventually run into the Wadi al-Arish, which drains the northern Sinai into the southeast corner of the Mediterranean at a place called Arish. That's the Brook of Egypt. And so we now know the southern border. And then the western border is exceptionally easy. It says on the west side, the Great Sea, the Mediterranean, shall be the boundary to a point opposite Libya Hamat. This shall be the west side. So that was to be the new promised land for the returning Israelis. And now it may, in fact, be the millennial promised land of the resurrected, transformed ethnic Israelis in the kingdom of Jesus. Verse number 21, so you shall divide this land among you according to the tribes of Israel. You shall allot it as an inheritance for yourselves and for the sojourners who reside among you. Now that's interesting. The sojourners mean non-Israelis who have moved in and want to be kind of honorary Israelis. They want to join in. And so that would be all of us Gentiles who have embraced the faith of Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus the Messiah, and have become honorary Israelis. We've been grafted into the tree of Israel, according to the book of Romans. So you shall have an allotment of yourselves and for the sojourners who reside among you and have had children among you. They shall be to you as native-born children of Israel. So they are not just simply honorees. They are Israelis. With you, they shall be allotted an inheritance among the tribes of Israel. In whatever tribe the sojourner resides, there you shall assign him his inheritance, declares he who is God. So it just depends on where they want to live as to which tribe they become a member of. Verse 1 of chapter 48. These are the names of the tribes, beginning at the northern extreme, beside the way of Hethlot, to Lebo Hamat, as far as Hazan Enan, which is in the northern border of Damascus over against Hamat, extending from the east side to the west, Dan, one portion. So the northernmost tribe is going to be Dan, which pretty much was the way it ended up being in the kingdom period as well, because the city of Dan was the northernmost occupied city of that time period. And it was the Danites that lived there. So what we're going to see now here is just the names of the tribes. They occupy from the Mediterranean coast all the way to the Jordan Valley, this boundary, this territory as their inheritance. It's where their farms are at. And all this land has come back to life again in the idea of the return, or as we're also saying, in the time of the millennium. And so every farm is a very productive farm. Plenty of agricultural stuff to go around for everybody that's here. And so Dan's the top one. Then Asher. And then Naphtali. And then Manasseh. And then Ephraim. And then Reuben. And then Judah. And then that takes us down to, you remember that holy zone right around the new city of Jerusalem in this return period where the temple was to be located. The priest lived and worked, and the Levites lived and worked right in that whole zone that was about an 8.17 miles by 8.17 miles. And so that's the holy zone. And then on the east and the west side of that, that's the prince's territory. You remember that? Well, Judah is the inheritance area immediately north of that. And so when you start looking at this, then you've basically got zones that are 40, 50 miles east to west, and then they're about 20 miles or so north to south. So they're very uniform, seems like, in this northern part. And then you have the whole holy zone that's mentioned in the next few sections. I want to skip down to verse number 23. As for the rest of the tribes, on the east side to the west, Benjamin one portion. So Judah is to the north of the holy and prince area. Benjamin is to the south of the holy and prince area, which is interesting because that's the reverse of what it was in the original inheritance. Benjamin was located tribally north of Jerusalem, and Judah was located tribally south of Jerusalem. So I don't know why God decided to flip it, but he did. And then you've got Simeon, that's south of Benjamin. And then Issachar comes next, which is interesting because Issachar was originally way up in the north. Same thing for Zebulun that comes next. And then Gad that comes after that. Gad being the most southern of this inheritance band. Down what would have been desert if it hadn't been for the fact that God brings the land back to life again because of his presence. His presence brings the water of life, brings the springs of life, and brings life back to the land. And so that apparently should have happened in the return from Babylon if they'd been faithful and God's presence had come. But certainly it will be true in the millennial period. Verse 29, this is the land that you shall allot as an inheritance among the tribes of Israel, and these are their portions, declares he who is God. And these shall be the exits of the city. So now we zoom back in on the city of Jerusalem itself. This is in the return, or now we're probably talking about the millennial period. On the north side, which is to be 4,500 cubits. Using the long cubit, that's about a mile and a half. And so here it says that the north side is to be about a mile and a half and have three gates. The gate of Reuben, the gate of Judah, the gate of Levi, the gates of the city being named after the tribes of Israel. Now, I find that interesting because in the book of Revelation, which we've already connected to the book of Ezekiel, in chapter number 21, the 12 gates into New Jerusalem are named after the sons of Israel. And so I expect that that will be connected to this here. So the next thing that we read is that on the east side, which will also be 4,500 cubits or about a mile and a half, three gates, Joseph, Benjamin, Dan. South side, Simeon, Issachar, Zebulun. West side, Gad, Asher, Naphtali. And so the circumference of the city shall be 18,000 cubits, and the name of the city from that time on shall be He Who Is There. So just to kind of give you a sense of the size of the city of Jerusalem as this return describes it, the old city of Jerusalem that you go and visit now is about 6/10 of a mile from wall to wall, east and west and north and south. So this is more than twice that size dimensions. So it would be overlaid into much of the more modern city of Jerusalem that's grown up on the west and the north and the south of the old city of Jerusalem. And the name that's supposed to be given here is that He Who Is here. He's here. Because the idea was if the Israelis would just trust God during their return from Babylon, then He would come and indwell their temple that they rebuilt, and He would then be with them literally in their presence from that time into eternity. And as I've said many times now as we've went through this, the whole story of Jesus coming as the atoning sacrifice for sin would have gone completely differently. Well, that finishes for us the final vision of Ezekiel as it is ordered in the book that we have today. However, chronologically, we've got another passage that we need to go to. So if you would go to Ezekiel chapter number 29, and we're going to pick up at verse 17, where there is a date that's given. It says here, in the 27th year, in the first month, on the first day of the month. Now, the 27th year would be his 27th year, Ezekiel's 27th year in Babylon. So the date that is rendered here in our calendar would basically be the first part of April, 572 BC. So a couple of years after this big, long vision that we had of the return temple and city and country. So in that time, the word of He Who Is came to me. Son of man, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, made his army labor hard against Tyre. Every head was made bald, every shoulder was rubbed bare, yet neither he nor his army got anything from Tyre to pay for the labor that he performed against her. So there had been a big push against the city of Tyre by Nebuchadnezzar, but people from Tyre basically retreated to the island and held out. And so Nebuchadnezzar was only kind of able to take off the mainland portion of Tyre. And the rest of God's judgment against Tyre would be carried out many years later under Alexander the Great against the people of Tyre that had moved out to the island. But in this time period, God says this. Verse 19, therefore, thus says He Who Is God, behold, I will give the land of Egypt to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and he shall carry off its wealth and despoil it and plunder it, and it shall be the wages for his army. I have given him the land of Egypt as his payment for which he labored, because they worked for me, declares he who is God. So God says, yes, he pushed hard against Tyre, didn't get as much out of it as he'd hoped, but I'm going to let him overflow part of Egypt, and that will pay him for the work that he did against Tyre. Because this is all about God's judgment against the peoples of the Middle East during this time period. Nebuchadnezzar was God's tool to judge all these sinful places. Verse 21, on that day, I will cause a horn to spring up from the house of Israel, and I will open your lips among them, and then they will know that I am he who is. So God just wants Ezekiel to sound off about God's judgments against all these peoples using the Babylonians, which brings us then to a lament over Egypt, which is about to get whacked. So chapter 30, the word of he who is came to me. Son of man, prophesy and say, thus says he who is God. Wail! Alas for the day! For the day is near. The day of he who is near. Now we've seen that the day of the Lord is a phrase that's not just about the final judgment of God related to Jesus' second coming. We get in the habit of thinking that way. But any time of judgment, big judgment of God, is a day of the Lord. And so there have been plenty of days of the Lord throughout history, and there was a bunch of them during this time period. And so it's going to be a day of clouds, a day of doom for the nations. So it's going to be a rough time. A sword shall come upon Egypt, and anguish shall come upon Cush. Cush is south of Egypt. It's what we call Ethiopia. When the slain fall in Egypt, and her wealth is carried away, and her foundations are torn away or torn down. So God's judgment is now coming through Nebuchadnezzar to the south. We're now about 16 years past the destruction of Jerusalem and Judah. So Nebuchadnezzar is well situated to make a move against Egypt now. Verse 5, Cush and Put and Lud, which are also places in Africa to the west of Egypt, and all Arabia and Libya. Of course, you know where Libya is at. That's in to the west of Egypt. Arabia is all the southlands from the direction of the Promised Land. So the Sinai is part of Arabia as well. And the people of the land that is in league shall fall with them by the sword. So a lot of these places were in alliance with Egypt. And so they're going to get whacked at the same time with God's judgment by the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. Thus says he who is, those who support Egypt shall fall. And her proud shall come down from Migdol to Syene, places in Egypt. They shall fall within her by the sword, declares he who is God. And they shall be desolated in the midst of desolated countries, and their cities shall be in the midst of cities that are laid waste. Then they will know that I am he who is, when I've set fire to Egypt, and all her helpers are broken. So Egypt is kind of on the tail end of God's Babylonian judgments. On that day, messengers shall go out from me in ships to terrify the unsuspecting people of Cush, and anguish shall come upon them on the day of Egypt's doom, for behold, it comes! So ships going down the Gulf of Suez arm of the Red Sea are going to take stories of Nebuchadnezzar's hitting of the delta region of Egypt with them to Cush, to Ethiopia, and that's going to scare Ethiopia bad. Thus says he who is God, I will put an end to the wealth of Egypt by the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. He and his people with him, the most ruthless of nations, shall be brought in to destroy the land. They shall draw their swords against Egypt and fill the land with the slain. And I will dry up the Nile and will sell the land into the hand of evildoers. And I will bring desolation upon the land and everything in it by the hand of foreigners. I am he who is. I have spoken. And thus says he who is, I will destroy the idols and put an end to the images in Memphis. And then from there on out, he just starts talking about all the places that are going to get hit and harmed by Babylonian influence. And verse 19 finishes it all up. Thus I will execute judgments on Egypt, and then they will know that I am he who is. So the Israelis needed to know that Egypt was also going to be punished during this time period. It was not the place to go and hide out from the Babylonians.